2 years ago, Americans watched in horror as a crisis unfolded at the Kabul airport.
She was tear-gassed and beaten.
Images of thousands desperate to escape Taliban oppression filled our news feeds. More than 80,000 Afghans made it to America. But the story didn't end there.
It was very cold. There was no power, no heat.
Who would help our newest neighbors? I'm Andrea Smartin. In Stranger Becomes Neighbor, you'll hear the stories of some remarkable refugees who left their homes and their dreams behind, only to start over from zero.
Their only possession was three blankets.
And you'll meet Americans who stepped up to help them.
You want me to come when you deliver your baby.
What can one person do in the face of an international disaster decades in the making? That's Stranger Becomes Neighbor. Find us at kslpodcast.com, follow us on Apple Podcasts, or anywhere else you listen.
Here in D.C. is essentially just another day. They have the bicycle barricade set up around the Capitol, but there are families here. There are school groups here for spring break. Congress now away for state work and the holidays, so not much hubbub happening in the Capitol right now. But we are seeing some reactions come in from members of Congress about what's happening today in New York. So far, Marco Rubio of Florida, the senator, he's calling this a bad day and one the country will regret for many years to come. The Republican National Committee, too, also echoing a similar sentiment. They are really rallying their base at this time, going after Manhattan DA Alvin Bragg, calling him someone who is abusing his power in this case. We have heard several times from Republicans and supporters of the former president about this indictment coming down today. Hakeem Jeffries, the New York Democrat, the House leader there, he is saying that this is an incitement of violence by MAGA extremists and saying that that will not be tolerated in New York. But across the board, those divisions here are still very much being echoed by what we're seeing on Capitol Hill to this indictment in New York, reacting to the president, former president, and this all transpiring here. But in D.C., we know they're in a posture of readiness at this time and ready to move if anything happens. But so far, no credible reports of any known threats they are saying, but they are definitely ready here on Capitol Hill, Alex.
You are listening to KSL AM Salt Lake City, KSL FM Midvale. You are listening to ABC coverage, live coverage of the indictment of former President Trump.
Contingent with Trump at the courthouse. He spoke to David Muir moments ago.
He's right now, David, only joined by one member of his legal team. It's a very small footprint with the former president, in addition to some Secret Service agents. As far as the rest of his legal team, and there are several, as you said earlier, that are with him for today, I'm told they are meeting with court staff right now, going through some logistics, some processing. They are waiting, David, to receive a copy of the indictment. I do not believe they've received it so far, according to my sources. But relatively shortly, I'm told the full legal team will join the former president, and very shortly, David, they will make that trip up to the 15th floor and head into that courtroom.
John Santucci from our investigative unit talking to David Muir. And to the point that he was making there a moment ago about Trump's legal team not seeing it, Royal Oaks, our legal contributor, that is normal, right? That they're going to learn. They know that he's been indicted. They have a pretty good idea of what it may be. But when they learn, we're going to learn as well.
Exactly right. And this is different from other grand jury procedures around the country. Normally, the indictments are unsealed well before the arraignment. But in this situation in New York, we're all finding out at the exact same time when that's unsealed and read. That's when the whole world finds out what the DA thinks he can prove against Donald Trump.
We are going to learn it together, likely here in the next 15 minutes or so. If everything is on time, it will be released. We will bring it to you. We will read through this. We're going to be reading through it in real time and raw with Royal and everybody else to understand really what it means against the former president of the United States. We know there's an indictment. There's been a lot of rumors about what might be in it, but we are going to know momentarily what is actually in there. And Josh Margolin, you heard Justin Finch talking about it's pretty quiet in D.C. today. I mean, relatively quiet in New York compared to some of the expectations of what it could have been. The former president had sent out messages about about making their voices heard, the supporters getting out and doing whatever they need to do. So far, pretty quiet.
Absolutely, Alex. And in fact, since the president or former president did say or express note that there could be quote unquote death and destruction as a result of the indictment and arraignment, what's been noted by officials is that there has been a lot of talking online and very little in the way of actual real violence. January 6th was a remarkable day, but it was really when the investigations have come out, the January 6th committee, it showed that what happened on January 6th was largely planned and largely pushed and fostered and coordinated. None of that type of thing has been noticed. And I got emails even this morning and texts from officials who had been monitoring this. And they say there's a lot of talk out there, not even that much talk anymore since the announcement of the indictment last Thursday. But there's been a lot of talk and very little action. And our teams spread out into Lower Manhattan near the courthouse where they have these collection areas where people are allowed to congregate and protest. There are protesters, but there's no sign of violence. There's no sign of problems. And yesterday we all watched as the mayor of New York City, standing next to the police commissioner, basically said, "This is our home here in New York City. You're welcome to come. We'd like to have you. Do not bring your violence here." And it has been borne out. But then again, we need to remember, as soon as the charges were announced last week, the NYPD immediately took a heightened security posture. The very next morning for Friday, they had every available police officer show up to work in uniform. So the detectives that you normally see roaming around in plain clothes, no, they were wearing uniform. That is all in designed to allow the commanders of the NYPD to deploy officers in large numbers to deter anybody who is thinking about doing something that could be violent. And the police have maintained that posture through the weekend and up until today. Importantly, tomorrow is Passover, the weekend is Easter. And so the NYPD was already in a heightened state of alert and awareness in terms of security measures because of the overarching concern about potential violence, anti-Semitic violence, anti-religious violence that could and is feared to possibly happen when you have a holiday like Passover, especially when it comes during Ramadan, in conjunction with Easter right at the same time. So the police, this is all to say the police are on high alert. And if anybody is down there watching this, they can very clearly see there are far more cops than there are protesters or anybody who wants to bring violence.
Steve Roberts, what does that say about the power of the former president at this point? He's still very much leading polling among Republicans, but at the same time, there were calls for protests and whatnot, and there's not a lot going on today. But there were also the calls, don't protest because of January 6th.
Well, you know, it's interesting because the president did raise, as Josh just mentioned, the possibility there'll be death and destruction if he is indicted. That has not happened, fortunately. The police presence and cooler heads have prevailed. But there is a political backlash brewing here. Maybe not in the streets, but in terms of campaign contributions and in current terms of political support for the president. You look at the latest polls, and Trump has surged way ahead of his chief opponent for the Republican nomination, Ron DeSantis. You look at the last four national polls and you average them, Trump is at over 50% among Republicans, DeSantis at 22%. The gap between them was only about 11 points just a month ago. So this indictment has definitely solidified politically, not just Trump's political standing among Republicans, but also his ability to raise money. And you have another factor here that Finch just mentioned the other day, a few minutes ago, which is that, remember, the single most important implication of Republicans winning the fall election in the House of Representatives is that they can now control all the House committees. Even though their margin is only a few votes in the House, they control every single committee. And three of those committees have already announced investigations into District Attorney Bragg's decision-making. Three of them are demanding information and documents about Bragg. And that's the foreshadowing, a forerunner of what we can expect, because going forward, Republicans are going to use this case, not just Trump personally, but the Republicans in the House are going to use this case to rally support, to reinforce their argument that the deep state is out to get Republicans and conservatives. And as was mentioned briefly earlier, you have the possibility of Republican district attorneys around the country, Republican prosecutors, saying, okay, if the Democrats in New York are going to go after Trump, we're going to use our power to go after Democrats, not just Hunter Biden, the president's son, but the possibility of retribution, the possibility of cases being brought. And, you know, the fact is, Alex, that politicians often do not anticipate what happens when the tables are turned, when the power turns to the other side. And there are a whole lot of Republicans who are looking at New York and today and saying, if Alvin Bragg can bring charges against Donald Trump, that frees us. That gives us permission to bring charges against Democrats around the country. And we're just seeing the beginning of that backlash.
Steve, this is early in the next presidential cycle, but do you think we're going to look back on this day and say Alvin Bragg handed the former president at least the Republican nomination, if not maybe the next presidency, if it were to go that way?
Well, I'm careful about predicting beyond tomorrow, let alone 18 months from now. I do think we can say, and the polls are very clear about this, we can say that Trump has gotten a boost among Republicans from this indictment. That is very clear. The polls have shifted very sharply in favor of Trump in the last few weeks. But the question, has it been a good week for Trump politically? Yes. Does it increase his chances of winning the nomination? Presumably, yes. But when you talk beyond that, it's a very different political dynamic. There are a lot of Republicans who are saying, this is actually a bad thing for us because Trump is a weak candidate. In fact, there was one Republican who argued on TV the other day, this is all a Democratic plot. Right? But to help hand the nomination to Trump because he is the weakest Republican candidate. It's all a Democratic plot. But the bottom line here is what works for Trump in the short run among voters who are going to vote in Republican primaries is very, very different, Alex, from the dynamic in the general election. And there are a lot of Democrats who are very nervous. A lot of Republicans who are very nervous about the long-term implications here, and that they think that yes, this can help Trump win the primaries, but boy, in the general election, this is a lot of ammunition to Democrats to use against those moderate suburban voters who are fed up with Trump and the Trump baggage. So, short-term helps Trump, long-term. Very different situation, Alex.
Steve, stand by. Go answer that phone call. We'll come back to you in a moment. We believe that this court hearing is about to get underway. If the hearing is on time, often they are not in courts. But we do know that the DA, Alvin Bragg, and his staff, they are in the courtroom. They arrived a moment ago, about a minute and a half ago, under the protection of officers. They are in place now. So it appears that we are getting close. ABC's Kate Shaw, our court expert and analyst, she spoke a moment ago about what she expects to happen in this court hearing.
I expect that the sort of norms that govern in the courtroom, the norms of law and not politics or political rhetoric, will be expected. Everyone present will be expected to speak in the language of law and not of politics. And I expect the former president's legal team will understand that that is the sort of directive that the judge explicitly or implicitly will be sending them. And I imagine the former president, too, to the extent that he does speak himself, will also adhere to the norms of the courtroom. What happens outside of the courtroom later in his remarks or elsewhere, of course, a different story.
Kate Shaw there, and any moment now we will likely find out what this indictment holds, what the counts are in there. Josh Margolin, our chief investigative reporter, you've been in this courthouse numerous times, covered a lot of different cases in there. If this goes as a typical arraignment would in the New York courts, what's going to go on?
Well, first of all, Alex, if it starts on time, that would be a rarity in New York courts. That's the most.
That would
important
show
thing.
He's not a normal defendant.
That would
right
certainly
there.
Show he's not a normal defendant on top of everything else, because we've sat in these courtrooms waiting and waiting and waiting for arraignments that last 30 seconds, but the wait can be hours long. But if it goes as this is supposed to go by the book, according to the normal procedure, they will go through some preliminaries. They will announce that court is in open session. The judge will probably admonish everybody to be calm and quiet. There is expected to be some discussion at the top, which may take more time than anything, between the judge and lawyers representing the coalition of news organizations who are covering this. There's going to be a discussion about the rules of the road for the day. There's going to be a discussion about moving forward and media access, and whether or not the media can tweet or type on laptops while this is going on today. The judge told the lawyers last night that any objections they might have to his strict ruling about media access, that those would be taken up before the arraignment. So the arraignment process is only going to last a few minutes at most. But that preliminary stuff could take, considerably longer. Then we'll get to the point they're going to announce the case. They will do all those preliminaries so that the court, reporter is able to take all the details down. They'll have it official for the record, because all of this is going to need to be done 100% right. It always needs to be done 100% right, but especially when you have somebody like Donald Trump, who is clearly going to be watching every single thing and potentially appealing every single thing. So they're going to go through all of that. Invariably, at some point, the judge is going to ask Trump how he pleads. It really is largely pro forma. Nobody, even if they want to plead guilty, nobody pleads guilty immediately. We're told by Trump's team that Trump himself will announce that he is pleading not guilty. As Royal said, maybe Trump will take the opportunity to embellish his not guilty plea, or he might play along with the normal script. Then there'll be some discussion about the rules, and obviously he's going to be let out on bail. He's not a risk to flee. He's not a risk of violence. This is not a violent crime. So any of those typical questions the judge might have about whether somebody can be released, those wouldn't come into play. And by the way, that is for anybody. So Donald Trump, except for some of the security measures and the motorcade with the Secret Service, Donald Trump is being treated pretty much today the way that any other white-collar criminal defendant would be treated when charged with offenses that are nonviolent. Violent, of course, being something that's like an assault or a homicide, of course, or a rape. None of that is at play here. So they're going to let Donald Trump go through this process. It'll last a few minutes, and then he will leave and get back into the vehicles. We understand from our teams downtown that the Secret Service, when they bring the person they're protecting to a location, they then immediately turn the vehicles around in order to have the vehicles ready to leave on a moment's notice. That has already happened. So outside the courthouse, they are ready for this to end and Trump to come back downstairs from the 15th floor, get back in the motorcade, head back out to LaGuardia Airport, get back on that plane that says Trump, and he will then proceed down to Mar-a-Lago in Palm Beach, where he's planning to hold an event where he's going to speak about these charges. So that's all that's going to happen. The run-up here is really taking far longer than the actual process itself. This is basically the shortest piece of any criminal trial, anything in the criminal justice system, just coming in for the arraignment, which is going to end with the guy walking out.
You can hear behind us now how quiet it is in the courtroom hall, police radios. That's about it. Police are protecting the courtroom. They've got metal barricades up. They're standing around waiting for all of this to begin and for us to find out what was in this indictment. Pretty much normal, Josh, but no handcuffs, we understand. And by the way, the former president has now been processed as a criminal defendant, did have his fingerprints taken. No handcuffs, and in case anybody wonders, no jail jumpsuit, right? I mean, you think of a cliche script of a court hearing, and you always hear the orange jail jumpsuit. That's not going on either.
That's not going on at all. Frankly, this would be a whole different thing if Donald Trump had been charged with a violent offense, beating somebody up, robbing somebody. None of that happened. He is being treated the way that business people that get arrested on white-collar criminal charges get treated in Manhattan. every single day. And officials have been, quick to tell us that because they don't want people to perceive that he's getting special treatment. They want people to perceive that he is being treated the way everybody else is, that if anybody else had committed his crimes, they would be charged. And if anybody else had been arrested like this, this is the process that they would undergo with some slight modifications and an asterisk because he has Secret Service protection as a former president.
We know from sources the former president was up early this morning. He was working the phone, speaking to aides and allies ahead of this appearance. We're told he was upbeat, relatively excited. We're told not angry, was resigned to the fact that this day was going to come, that, that he knew that he was going to have to do this, and he was doing it kind of on his terms of arriving yesterday, of making his way into Manhattan, and then not going into handcuffs and being there today. Royal Oaks, ABC News legal contributor, when we finish all of this up, what do you expect the next stage would be? Are we talking about another hearing days from now, weeks from now, months from now? What would typically come next?
The next step would generally be the judge saying, okay, we're going to have a hearing a few weeks down the road to try to schedule things. And in that interim, both sides would decide, okay, what do we need? How much time do we want? Now, Trump has a constitutional right to a speedy trial, so he can insist on relatively few delays and have a trial later this year, maybe before too long, if he wants. We don't know if that's his political calculus. Perhaps his view will be, I want time for my guys and gals to prepare, and I want this to happen in 2024. We just don't know about that. But the main thing that's going to happen during that interval, I think, is for everybody to evaluate just what is the nature of the allegation by the DA. How does the DA bootstrap it up from misdemeanor to felony, if that, in fact, is what's happening?
But isn't part of his historical playbook when it comes to cases that he's been involved in is to delay them as long as he can, and then sometimes they kind of fizzle out, but delay, delay, delay?
Absolutely. The mantra for Donald Trump, as we know, and lots of people have commented on it lately, is first of all to attack, and he certainly has attacked this judge, claiming this judge and the DA are biased, but also to delay. That, you could have an asterisk on that, Alex, if he believes the delay would be a negative for his campaign if it creeps into 2024. And then, of course, the wild card, as you've reported, is this just the first shoe? Will other shoes drop? I mean, will there? We've seen some reports and confirmed that Atlanta DA is thinking about indicting him very soon. What about the Mar-a-Lago documents? What about the January 6th insurrection idea? It is very possible that this case will be in everybody's rearview mirror before too long. But right now, it's dead straight ahead of us, and everybody is waiting with great curiosity to find out exactly the nature of these 30-some-odd counts by the DA against Trump.
Assuming this case goes on for a while, does this case impact Georgia or the documents probe or January 6th? Can they impact each other?
You know, because they are so disparate geographically and substantively and time-wise, there really shouldn't be any sort of interaction problem. I mean, theoretically, if Donald Trump is very busy defending himself in one case, he's going to have a very legitimate excuse and explanation for not dealing with the others, and so he may get lengthy delays there. You know, one possible game or play that Trump might make is if things do tend to drag on, it wouldn't be unheard of for a criminal defendant to say as we get well into 2024, well, you know, it's not really fair for this to happen now because I'm busy running for president, and we all know the judicial system and prosecutors don't like to interfere with elections. So how about putting these indictments on the shelf, the trials on the shelf, and we'll see if I get elected. If I am, then I'll face trial after I get out. I mean, talk about surreal. It sounds pretty bizarre, but that kind of thing could happen if it gets close to November 24. So perhaps that will be part of Trump's playbook.
Steve Roberts, if you were the former president, do you keep this going so that you've got a boogeyman out there to say, you know, look, this is going on, they're coming after me? Would getting rid of it potentially take that away?
I think that this is a good question, Alex, and I think the answer is that anything that feeds Trump's sense of grievance, anything that keeps the red light on, anything that keeps him in center stage, anything that allows him to send out those fundraising appeals that are he's inundated his supporters with, he sees this as a political plus. So actually, I think in terms of the New York case, he's likely to see this as a political asset and likely to keep this going because it plays into this larger framework, not just of the swamp is out to get me and the deep state is out to get me. There's a larger, which is a little odd because Trump himself is from New York City, but he has played very successfully the argument to the American heartland. It's the elites, the coastal elites, Hollywood and the Ivy League and big tech and the big networks like ABC, they're all out to get me. And so this feeds his narrative. In some ways, Alex, if Trump were drawing up a day, drawing up a script, drawing up a drama that would play into his political arguments and his political strategy, today would look a lot like what he would draw up, because he can use this to say, see, it's not just the elites, it's those New Yorkers, those coastal elites who look down on the rest of you in flyover country. And, you know, it's interesting because this has been a very effective political argument for Donald Trump. And just lately, Joe Biden has been sprinkling his speeches with references to voters who feel forgotten, references who feel voters who feel invisible, Alex. And this is borrowing Trumpian language. This is understanding and reflecting that Trump has been very successful at using these arguments politically. So bottom line here, I think today Trump sees it as a political plus, and he's going to try to keep it going, Alex.
Behind us, you're hearing the squawks of police radios from the court services that are doing the protection inside the hallway. We have not yet seen the former president make his way into the courtroom. Do not believe that the hearing is underway right now. It should have started about 10 minutes ago, but you heard Josh say court cases never, especially in New York, do they ever actually get underway on time. We know that he has surrendered. He's gone through the booking process. And if you're just joining us, maybe on the East Coast, if they're not in spring break, you're going to pick your kids up from school on the West Coast, heading out to lunch, you are listening to coverage right now of former President Trump, who has turned himself in. He has surrendered. He has been arrested on the indictment that we still don't have details on. We know his fingerprints were taken. He was processed moments ago. We are now waiting on the arraignment that will be quick, likely only about 15 minutes entering a plea. We assume will be not guilty, and we will get details on the indictment and what is in there. And talking about all these different cases, Josh Margolin, it was actually Georgia that was believed was going to go before this case, right?
Right, Alex. And in fact, we had gotten some inkling that the DA in Georgia was very satisfied with the grand jury investigation there and that she would proceed with it. We thought that this case was going to be second. We did get the sense as New Year began and then went from January to February to March, we got a growing sense that this case was picking up momentum. But we did think Georgia was going to come first. And then we do all know that hanging out there in the distance, and it's not entirely clear what kind of distance we're talking about right now, we have the additional investigations. We have the January 6th investigation that has been zeroing in on Trump's conduct that day and whether or not he incited or conspired to incite or to conspire to incite the mob to lead the insurrection. And then, of course, we have the classified documents investigation. And we, over the last number of days, have seen a lot of movement in that case. Remember, that's the case where the FBI raided Mar-a-Lago, Trump's home in Florida, to get back these classified documents and documents that had been sought by the archives, and Trump was not supposed to have them, and they allegedly had not been kept in secure locations in Florida. So all of this is hanging over his head, in addition to civil cases. And we know that one of them is supposed to start fairly soon, later this month.
We're waiting the former president, some of the attorneys walking into the courtroom now for the arraignment to begin in this moment that Americans have never seen. Here now, President Trump is walking out of after he was processed moments ago, walking through a door. Very serious, stern-looking face with his red tie and blue suit on, walking into the courtroom now. Those who are in the courtroom, they are not allowed to send out electronic messages. There are no cameras or microphones in there. You would assume the moment he arrives or shortly thereafter, the court hearing would begin. That was the brief moment in between surrendering, being technically arrested, his fingerprints taken, to then going into the courtroom, and now he will enter that plea and answer to the judge how he pleads to the counts that we should know momentarily what the counts are in the indictment. ABC's Royal Oaks, our legal analyst, this is about to be the moment that he's going to find out as well, the former president, what is in that indictment, right?
I'm Dave Cauley, investigative journalist and host of the podcast Cold. Don't miss Cold's new Season 3, where I look into the unsolved disappearance of Cherie Warren, a woman last seen leaving her job at a Salt Lake City office in 1985. Police cast suspicion on Cherie's estranged husband and boyfriend, but never made any arrests or recovered Cherie's remains. Find Cold Season 3, The Search for Cherie, anywhere you get your podcasts.
That's right, and it's going to really boil down to the question of how serious these allegations are, felony versus misdemeanor. For the action alleged by Bragg to be a felony rather than a misdemeanor, prosecutors are going to have to show, Alex, that Trump falsified business records with the intention of committing a second crime. Now, that second crime can be a controversial aspect of the case against Trump. To the extent the DA is invoking alleged federal campaign finance violations as the second crime, that could be a problem because presidential elections are governed by federal law. It's not clear that Bragg has a theory by which a state campaign law covered Trump's actions, or if a state prosecutor even has a right to cite a law over which he has no jurisdiction. It's possible Bragg has evidence of another intended second offense. For example, an intent to deduct payments as a business expense on tax returns. We're speculating here. All we know is that the beating heart of the case is likely to be Section 175 of the Penal Code in New York pertaining to false business entries. We don't know specifically what he has on Donald Trump in terms of what Trump did to accomplish that, if he did in fact do it, and if it bumps up to that second crime that could make this a felony charge.
Royal, it's important to point out to get an indictment, you only need enough to say there could be a crime there. It's not beyond a reasonable doubt. Could the case fall apart, not knowing what's in it yet? Getting an indictment is not a guilty conviction. Do they fall apart sometimes?
No, you're right. The standard is probable cause to arrest somebody or search somebody or for somebody to go to trial. And probable cause is defined as where a reasonable person would suspect that a crime may have been committed, as you suggest, not exactly that higher bar of beyond a reasonable doubt. And lots of ways for cases to fall apart. The statute of limitations, for example, is a possibility. The bookkeeping fraud count, it's a 2-year statute in New York as a misdemeanor, but 5 years as a felony. Now, and Michael Cohen made these payments to Stormy Daniels 6 years ago, so it sounds like that's too late. But New York law extends those limits when somebody is living outside of New York, and we know Donald Trump was in Washington, D.C. for 4 years, and during the pandemic, New York also extended the statute by over a year. So that's probably a long-shot argument for Trump to knock it out. And then as to whether it falls apart in the eyes of a jury, well, it really is going to depend, I think, on what they think of the credibility of Michael Cohen when he takes the stand and testifies against Donald Trump.
Now, this is KSL News Radio. You are listening to live ABC coverage of former President Trump in a New York courtroom. The former president has walked into the courtroom, and now we are waiting to hear the charges against him.
Former president going to jail for whatever this ends up being once we know what the case entails. Would a former president be sentenced to jail time for something like this?
Probably nobody would likely be facing prison time because it's a first offense, and just in general, judges would tend to not give any prison time, even in a felony context here. But Of course, as a practical matter, Alex, that probably wouldn't help Trump too much, because not only if this case results in a conviction, but you've got these other cases like airplanes lined up ready to land in LaGuardia. 57% of Americans in a recent poll said if somebody's under indictment, they really shouldn't run. Well, what if you've got two, three or four indictments? What if you have one or two convictions? Even though technically it doesn't bar him from serving as president, because only an espionage or an insurrection conviction would bar you from becoming president. I think this is a formula for the nation going from Trump fatigue to Trump utter exhaustion. And as some have said on this broadcast, that may be a strategy by the Democrats to make sure that Trump is the nominee, not DeSantis, but a weakened Trump who will barely limp across the finish line and be a pretty easy candidate for Joe Biden to defeat.
The court hearing, it would seem, is underway right now. Former President Trump, after being processed, walked into the courtroom moments ago. The judge has said no microphones in that courtroom. So this is likely going to be 10, 15 minutes long, and then come out and we find out what is in the indictment and what went on in the courtroom. Maybe even hear from the former president. That's not yet clear. Kachon, Dan Abrams, a few moments ago talking about what will be going on. Will it be a speaking indictment? Any of that?
I expect we're going to see a good amount of detail, narrative, not just this sort of bare bones kind of bullet point charges. I certainly hope so, because we are all hoping and viewers are all hoping to get a real sense of what the case will look like when the DA puts it on. And so I have to imagine that's informing the decision. So I do expect a speaking indictment.
I think that, in conjunction with the fact that he's already announced he's going to have a press conference afterwards, tells you that there's going to be information in there. I mean, this is not going to be the sort of thing where he's just going to say, okay, this is the legal charges, et cetera, and we're not going to discuss it beyond that. He's going to hold a press conference. I'd expect there's going to be detail in the indictment as well that will explain exactly what they think that the president did, why it's a violation of the law, et cetera. And that's the key, right? It's not just the law, it's the facts. And how the facts relate to the law. And that's what a speaking indictment really does, is it doesn't just say a violation of this particular law, and here's the definition of the law. It explains why the facts in this case show that there was a violation.
Kachon, Dan Abrams there. And as they were speaking, Steve Roberts, we found out former President Trump's campaign a few moments ago blasted out to supporters are now selling a T-shirt with a photoshopped image of a fake mugshot on the front. We don't even think he took a mugshot. It is not his actual mugshot. But you talk about making money off of this immediately. He just got processed moments ago, and already that is campaign cash coming in. This is a moneymaker.
Because online fundraising, has advanced the whole process so much, because you're able to beam out an appeal like that and have instantaneous emotional reactions, and there's that big red donate button. It takes a couple of seconds. In the old days, raising money, you had to clip a coupon, find a stamp, find a mailbox. Today, it has accelerated so much, and Trump has been a genius at utilizing that short-term instantaneous reaction to raise money. And he's done this many, many times in many ways. But the core of his appeal is always, they're out to get me. And so this meme of him as a mugshot, it just plays into all the Trumpian strategies we've known for many, many years, Alex, which is the sense of grievance, the sense of victimization. Trump as a indicted felon, this is very much a part of the long-term strategy that Trump has used over and over again to raise money, to rally his supporters, to increase the excitement of MAGA Nation. Along with that, you get a red hat that says, and that says, I'm part of the tribe. And he's been able to use that over and over and over again, that sense of loyalty, that sense of connection, that sense of victimization. It's pure Trump, and we see it again today, Alex.
Now, of course, historically, the former president has always used an opponent or some kind of, whether it be the last election or Hillary Clinton. This no doubt could come into and will be the opposing side coming against him. But Steve, do you get to a point where there are so many cases that we now are lined up in the hopper that that it doesn't help, that it actually hurts, or is more better?
Depends on who you're talking to and what constituency you're talking to. I think with the purebred MAGA nation, it continues to help. But I've always believed this is maybe somewhere between 30 and 35% of American voters, no more than that. You got to remember that Donald Trump, yes, he won 137 million votes in his two tries for the presidency, but he never was a majority candidate. He got 46 plus in both elections. He only beat Hillary Clinton because a lot of Democrats stayed home or voted third party. So he can use this to rally his core base of support, but a lot of Republicans are saying it's just not enough. You look at Paul Ryan, former Republican Speaker of the House, has been saying over and over again, Donald Trump is a loser because for all the ways in which a day like today enhances the loyalty and excitement and the willingness to give money on the part of his core supporters, it will drive away others. So this today is ammunition for both sides, interesting enough, Alex. Both sides will hold up today, and Trump will hold it up and say, see, I told you they're against me, send money. And the Democrats will hold up today and say, see, we told you, Trump means chaos. Trump means confusion. Trump means instability. Both sides will draw on today using the same memes, the same ideas, but with very different appeals and to very different constituencies, Alex.
And one has to wonder, with Georgia and the documents probe and everything else, are we going to be doing this time and time again in the next couple of months, depending on where those cases go as well? Don Mihalik, formerly Secret Service. Don, January 6th, what impact did that have on the security posture that is underway right now, of the intense security around the courthouse preventing another January 6th?
I think January 6th taught everybody a couple of lessons. Number one, don't downplay intelligence. When you get threat intelligence, make sure you take it seriously. Number two, planning is the best preparation to protect against violence. And number three, I think it taught a lot of the people that were watching January 6th that if you conduct an act of violence like that against a government institution, there's going to be serious repercussions. I think there were over 1,000 people charged and arrested in the January 6th riot on the Capitol. And I think that message was sent loud and clear from the U.S. government to the nation. And I think for the law enforcement agencies involved, and now up in New York, which generally New York tends to work pretty well from the lessons learned after 9/11, they made sure that they planned, coordinated, and put together a robust security plan so that way they could ensure that any threats were identified, there was mitigation steps put in place to make sure that the bubble around this situation was safe and that the public, most importantly, in and around New York City would be kept safe. And as the mayor said, that any rabble-rousers wouldn't cause problems in and around the city.
Even though video cameras are not allowed inside, microphones not allowed either, broadcast microphones, still cameras were allowed in for a short period of time. And we are now getting our first images from the Associated Press of a defendant, Donald Trump, sitting just like any other defendant at the defendant's table with his attorneys around him. He is in his blue suit with a red tie on, sitting with a serious expression on his face as the court hearing gets underway and by now maybe even is getting toward the end. And the complexity of this hearing, Royal Oaks, this is pretty straightforward, right? You hear the charges against you, deal with some housekeeping stuff, enter a plea, and then you're out.
That's exactly right, and that's why an arraignment, of course, isn't the most substantive of hearings, and yet it can be turned into the theater in a way. O.J. Simpson, when he was forced to go to trial on murder, he made headlines by defiantly saying, I am absolutely, positively, 100% not guilty. I mean, he uttered so many words, we were kind of surprised Judge Ito didn't cut him off and say, all right, you know, I get the idea. Who knows, maybe Donald Trump we'll take the opportunity here to say a little bit more than simply the words not guilty.
He is now in the courtroom, and the process is getting underway right now. Josh Margolin, chief investigative reporter, I was talking about that image a moment ago that I mean, quite honestly, we've all covered a lot of trials. He looks like any other defendant sitting in that courtroom with the wood-paneled walls and the wood table and leather chairs.
Right. So, Alex, now we get to quote Donald Trump. This is surreal, right? So we are actually seeing a picture where Donald Trump, former president of the United States, is stripped of all of the trappings of power. He's stripped of all of the trappings of his life as a New York City developer, the lifestyle, high-flying, the apprentice, helicopters, and gold, and Trump Tower. We are looking at another defendant. And in some ways, it's just another defendant. He is sitting in the same place that has been occupied by lawyers and defendants. You know, he's surrounded by his lawyers. There is no Secret Service. There are no hangers-on. There is no, you know, Marine band. This is a man sitting there in the place that has been occupied by mobsters and murderers and muggers and thugs and gangbangers for time immemorial in New York City. And that is what has now happened to Donald Trump, the former president of the United States.
The world is going to see this image soon enough. If you're driving right now, and you'll see it, I'm sure, before the day is out, of the former president sitting there at the table, slunched over, hunched over a little bit, as he's sitting with his hands down what looks like in his lap. Steve Roberts, you know, we talk about capitalizing on all of this. Is that the image he wants, or his biggest fear to show him as a defendant in a criminal court?
I think it's both. You know, because Donald Trump has spent years and years and years avoiding this moment. He's faced a lot of legal jeopardy in the past because of his business dealings, his many bankruptcies. He's been sued countless times. The legal cases against the Trump Organization that we mentioned earlier, where one of his chief financial officers went to jail, his chief fixer and legal advisor, Michael Cohen, went to jail. People around him have sat in that seat and eventually been convicted. And he's always skated free. Today, finally, for the first time, in some ways, that fear has come true. So it can't be a good feeling sitting there, as just been described, in that seat that so many others have sat before him as a accused felon. But on the other hand, if you step back from it, politically, Donald Trump has also often proved himself to be very adept and very clever and very shrewd at exploiting these moments, and using them to not just raise money, but to galvanize his supporters and force other Republicans to line up behind him. If it's us against them, if it's Donald Trump versus the DA in Manhattan, even people who don't like Donald Trump and are upset about the possibility of him being the Republican nominee right now, short term, they're going to line up behind him and accuse this DA of bringing an unfair case against the former president. So I think there's a lot of mixed emotions in that photograph. It's never a good feeling to be accused of a crime, but he also understands how he can use that politically, Alex.
Well, again, we mentioned that already, fundraising on a mugshot that wasn't even taken, a fake mugshot, is being sent out to supporters to buy a T-shirt that has a mugshot that some may believe is real but is not. And the fundraising got going even before this day. But as the hearing is happening, as it is in this moment, money is being raised in real time for the campaign. And we expect this hearing to end any moment, and we're waiting to find out what those counts are that likely are being read in the courtroom right now against the former president. We may hear from him. We do expect we're going to hear from D.A. Alvin Bragg here in the next maybe 45 minutes or so, but everything's a little bit delayed, so it may be a while there. Chris Christie, now an ABC News analyst and consultant, former confidant of the former president, former governor of New Jersey. He was talking moments ago about how the former president avoids paper trails, maybe to avoid documents from being entered into a trial like this one.
What we're talking about here is something that he has worked hard his entire life to avoid by the way he conducts his business. No emails, no text messages. When he speaks to you about business, he speaks in a kind of code language where you don't always know exactly what he's saying, but you kind of get a feeling for what he's implying. He's done all that because I think Roy Cohn taught him to do that. not to have any paper trail. And so this is going to be interesting to see what's in the indictment, what documents they have. I can guarantee you this much. They're not from Donald Trump. I never got an email from him in the 22 years I've known him. Never got a text message from him in the 22 years I've known him. He just doesn't do it.
Chris Christie there, and Josh Margolin, interesting because he was known for Twitter, now Truth Social, always on his phone tweeting out. But beyond that, the New Yorker is known for not sending a lot of electronic documents.
Electronic documents. He doesn't like documents at all. There are all sorts of stories that came out of the White House where he would finish a meeting and he would tear up the documents, and you have these aides that would then have to scrounge around on the floor in the waste paper basket to find the shreds of the documents and then tape them back together so they could be saved, because as President of the United States, you have to save your documents by rule of law. But yes, he was a notorious Twitterer, and now he posts on Truth Social. He was posting things on the way into court this morning. He said it was surreal. He also talked about this idea that this trial should be moved to Staten Island, which is known as the most conservative of the five New York City boroughs. But yes, like Chris Christie said, this is a man who has spent his entire business career, long before a political career, trying to, you know, run right along the edge of what's legal and avoid being in criminal court.
Talking about change of venue, that's interesting, Josh. That is that something that typically in New York courts all of your years that they would do? I feel like the population is so big that you can prove that you would get a fair jury in any kind of a trial, but when it's the former president, when it's him, could they get a fair jury in Manhattan?
Well, I think the first thing we have to say is that his lawyers have already discounted the possibility that he is going to seek a change of venue. Second thing is the question of a defendant seeking to change of venue. Those efforts usually fail in most places, and they don't necessarily get to choose the venue they change. There was a famous case of police brutality in New York City that the venue got changed. It went up to Albany in the middle of upstate New York. So the idea that Trump could decide they want to go to Staten Island because it's more favorable, and why would the DA go along with that? Because, yes, Staten Island is a more conservative, has a few more Republicans, considerably more Republicans by percentage than, say, Manhattan. But the general notion, you know, the technical legalistics of a change of venue, would you have a better chance of getting a fair trial elsewhere because you have no real chance of getting a fair trial here? I don't know that there's anybody in the country that doesn't know who Donald Trump is, that doesn't already have an opinion of Donald Trump. If you're the judge, you have to say, is there any real chance that a jury anywhere would be fairer to him? Maybe. But yes, the logic is, and this is why he's no longer officially a Manhattan resident, he's switched residency to Florida. The logic is that New York is so left-leaning, so heavily Democrat. He was a Republican president who was aggressively anti-Democrat, and therefore people in Manhattan would not be fair toward him. I don't know what the possibilities are. It's impossible to handicap if we were betting on it, but he's already put that out.
A source in the courtroom telling our John Santucci that Trump has now pleaded not guilty to the counts against him. Again, no electronic devices, no microphones, broadcast mics allowed in there, so we don't know a lot of what is going on in this moment. But we do understand that he has pleaded not guilty, and this hearing may be ending soon, and then we will get a lot of detail about what went on in there. Our teams are in there, and details of what is in the indictment. So we wait to see the former president come out of the courtroom. We have eyes on the hallway right outside, and then we'll know it is over. But Royal Oaks, our ABC News legal contributor, talking about the lack of the former president wanting anything in document form. But how does that impact something like this? If you don't have emails, if you don't have physical documents, look, there's a whole probe on holding on to some documents that maybe should not have been at Mar-a-Lago. Generally speaking, a lack of documents, what does that mean to a case?
Boy, that point that Chris Christie made a couple of minutes ago is just huge. For 22 years to go by in their relationship, and he never got an email, he never got a text. Trump never puts anything in writing and always speaks in sort of vague terms. That's huge, and here's why, Alex. The very fundamental element of the DA's case, we believe, is going to be that Donald Trump with intent to defraud, made false entries in his business records, or, according to the statute, caused to make false entries. Well, good luck proving that Donald Trump actually did something with the document. That then brings Michael Cohen in. He will probably testify, yes, Donald Trump caused me and others to make false entries. All that $130,000 wasn't for some porn actress. It was for legal fees. That is going to be the case against Donald Trump. And similarly, phase two, okay, he did that in order to commit another crime, namely a campaign violation. I don't want to tell the campaign people in Washington that the money was for Stormy Daniels. I want to tell them it was for legal fees. That kicks it up to the felony. So yeah, I think to the extent Donald Trump is famous for not putting anything in writing, that could be a huge aspect of his defense in this case.
But if you say, well, he didn't tell me, but, you know, insinuated, used code words, same thing in Georgia, the alleged case there, if that does go forward, you know, we've all heard the recordings there of pushing for whatever it was that he was pushing for in the Georgia vote. If it's always kind of right up to the line, but then insinuating, how do you prove that in court?
Yeah, other than Michael Cohen's testimony and other than some documents that may sort of figuratively bear Donald Trump's fingerprints, perhaps the filing of a tax return that he signed where he may ask for certain deductions, if it can be construed that the tax return was fraudulent, maybe that will be the second crime that the district attorney can rely on. It really boils down to the fact that, as you were just discussing, in terms of getting a fair jury, how can you get 12 people who haven't already made up their mind that Donald Trump is either the devil or the angel? And that's really just a matter of the judge buckling down, rolling up his sleeves, and questioning potential jurors for maybe up to weeks to finally find the people who, of course, they have opinions about Donald Trump, but they can be fair in this situation. So, yeah, I wouldn't bet on moving this out of the New York area because the publicity is huge everywhere, and Trump's not going to get very far making an argument that, well, everybody in all of the boroughs except Staten Island are very liberal, and therefore you really ought to move me out to Bayonne, New Jersey.
Political analyst Steve Roberts, so won't that be an argument? Well, they didn't move the trial, and so therefore it wasn't fair?
Sure, and move it to Bayonne, New Jersey, he just mentioned. That's my hometown. It's right across the river from Manhattan and a stone's throw from Staten Island. I'm sure Bayonne would be thrilled to have the Trump trial to bring in a lot of money. I think that's a good idea. I'm going to promote that one. But sure, Trump is going to argue that Manhattan is liberal. It's against him. He can't get a fair trial. But it's a bit odd argument since he made his fortune there. He lives there, or did up until recently. He was there overnight in the Trump Tower. He announced it for president in 2015, coming down that famous gold escalator from the Trump Tower. So the oddity here is that Donald Trump made his fortune in New York. He made his reputation in New York. He has buildings branded after him in New York. So to make the argument, oh, by the way, I can't get a fair trial in New York where all these buildings have my name on it. That's not going to be a particularly compelling argument, Alex.
Royal, when we talk about, you know, let's just say it goes as far as a jury trial. If there were a jury involved, how do you even begin? Everybody knows who he is. As we've mentioned, everywhere you go. How do you even begin finding jurors? You ask, do you know who Donald Trump is? Of course they know who Donald Trump is. How do you pick a fair jury?
Well, step one is to have a huge pool of 200, 300 or more, as opposed to typically have a few dozen in a non-high-profile case. Step two is spend a lot of time with them, and both sides, the lawyers on both sides, get to question them thoroughly and strike a bunch of them. The judge gets to question them as well. So I think that's the way you do it. You have to have a trial, and you have to have 12 people. My pet peeve, Alex, I've sort of facetiously suggested, what about polygraph machines, lie detectors? Okay, they're only 95% right, but we're not sending anybody to jail. We're just thanking and excusing a juror and giving them a lovely parting gift if it turns out, according to the machine, they're lying. So you can do it somehow. You know, on the venue issue we've been talking about, Alex, judges don't want to move because usually the judge moves too. If this were moved to St. Louis, this judge would have to live in St. Louis for as many months as this takes. takes. You know, you need extraordinary circumstances. Think back to that horrific Oklahoma City bombing. The city, of course, was unified in their hatred for that bomber. And that was a good reason to move the case to Denver. You don't have that kind of situation here. This is a very different deal. And so I think this case is going to stay in New York City.
Is it expected that Judge Mershon, he would be throughout? This isn't like some courts, and maybe Josh can jump in on this as well, but like some courts where you have a judge at arraignment and another judge later on. This, without something changing, Mershon will be throughout the entire case?
Yeah, the head judges have the power to move people around like chess pieces, but in all likelihood, this judge would stick with it. And as we've talked about today, this judge just finished working on the Trump Organization crime case, and he had some very strong language saying that there was a lot of evidence of felonious activity at the Trump Organization. The judge authorized a $1.6 million fine. The judge had promised Weisselberg, the CFO for Trump, a five-month sentence, and later said if he hadn't promised that, I'd give him more time. The Trump Organization was found guilty on 17 counts. So, yeah, very likely this judge will stick with the case, and Donald Trump will possibly continue to be outspoken criticizing him and suggesting that this judge just hates Trump.
And because of that background, that's why members of the Trump team have been saying they believe this is unfair to be under Judge Juan Mershon, and that they want another judge. Would they ever be happy with any judge? Who knows? But they say they don't want this one. Royals, stay close. We believe that we're going to get this indictment momentarily, and we will know these counts, the dozens of counts that the former president learned about moments ago. Now has pleaded not guilty in the courtroom. He has not yet come out. They likely are dealing with housekeeping-type stuff right now of deciding the next hearing date, what the rules are going to be, will there be a gag order, all of that, what the rules on the media, and how they move forward, but we should know more, and we're going to go through them one by one with Royal to figure out what they all mean. In the meantime, Karen Travers, the politics.
And you are listening to KSL AM Salt Lake City, KSL FM Midvale, and we will continue to await the charges here against former President Trump.
A stranger with a gun came upon two teens taking pictures under a rising full moon. But violence is only the beginning of this story.
Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and I've spent my career talking about how lives are undone by violence. The Letter is a podcast about how lives are remade. Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.